And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. And as I have learned, to my dismay, also one of the most corrupt. Laws don't mean anything here. As a 100% disabled veteran, I don't pay property taxes. And because of that, the police and the sheriff have told me I'm not entitled to protection because that costs money. So, as I told the sheriff's office, I'll protect myself. Well, it's August the 16th, 228th day of the year. 137 days remain till the year's over with. In 1 BC, Wang Mang consolidates his powers, declared Marshal of State. Emperor Ai of Han, who died the day before, had no heirs. 942, started the four-day Battle of Al-Mada'in between the Hamdanids of Mosul and the Bandits of Basra over the control of the Basid capital, Baghdad. And, as I say, it lasted 4 days. Blood and guts flowing like water. 963, Nikephoros II Phokas is crowned emperor of the Byzantine Empire. That was the Eastern Roman Empire initially. 1328, the House of Gonzaga seizes power in the Duchy of Mantua. They'll hold power until 1708. 1513, Battle of the Spurs, also known as the Battle of Guinegate. Henry VIII of England and his imperial allies defeat French forces who had been forced to retreat. 1570, the Principality of Transylvania is established under John II Zapolya, but he renounces his claim as King of Hungary in the Treaty of Speyer. They got to give him something, so they gave him Transylvania. 1652, Battle of Plymouth, inconclusive naval action between the fleets of Michel de Ruyter and George Askew in the First Anglo-Dutch War. 1777, American Revolutionary War. The Americans, led by General John Stark, rout the British and the Brunswick troops under Frederick Baum at the Battle of Bennington in Wallonsack, New York. 1780, American Revolutionary War. Battle of Camden. British defeat the Americans near Camden, South Carolina. 1792, Maximilien de Robespierre presents the petition of the Commune of Paris to the legislative authority, which demanded the formation of a revolutionary tribunal. Everybody wants to have a revolutionary tribunal that gives them ultimate power. He eventually was the victim of his own attempt to seize power. 1793, French Revolution. A levy en masse is decreed by the National Convention. 1812, War of 1812. American General William Hull surrenders Fort Detroit without a fight to the British Army. That didn't make him popular. 1819, the Peterloo Massacre. 17 people die and 600 are injured in cavalry charges at a public meeting at St. Peter's Field in Manchester, England. 1841, President John Tyler vetoes a bill which called for the reestablishment of the Second Bank of the United States. Enraged Whig Party members riot outside the White House in the most violent demonstration of White House grounds in U.S. history. They wanted a central bank to control currency, and he who controlled the bank controlled the country. 1858, President James Buchanan inaugurates the new transatlantic telegraph cable by exchanging greetings with Queen Victoria of the UK. However, a weak signal forces a shutdown of the service in just a few weeks. 1859, the Grand Duchy of Tuscany formally deposes the exiled House of Lorraine. 1863, the Dominican Restoration War begins when Gregorio Luperon raises the Dominican flag in Santo Domingo after Spain had recolonized the country. 1869, Battle of Costa New. A Paraguayan battalion made up of children is massacred by the Brazilian army during the Paraguayan War. 1870, Franco-Prussian War. The Battle of Mars-la-Tour is fought, resulting in a Prussian victory. 1891, the Basilica of San Sebastian, Manila, the first all-steel church in Asia, is officially inaugurated and blessed. 1896, Sukum, Jim Mason, George Carmack, and Dawson Charlie discover gold on a tributary of the Klondike River in Canada. And that sets off the Klondike Gold Rush. 1900, the Battle of Eland River during the Second Boer War ends after a 13-day siege is lifted by the British. The battle had begun when a force of between 2,000 and 3,000 Boers surrounded a force of 500 Australian, Rhodesian, Canadian, and British soldiers at a supply dump at Brakfontein Drift. 1906, an 8.2 Valparaiso earthquake hit central Chile. Kills 3,882 people. Haiti yesterday just had a 7.6, I think, earthquake. 1913, Tohoku Imperial University, Japan, modern-day Tohoku University, becomes the first university in Japan to admit female students. 1913, completion of the Royal Navy battlecruiser HMS Queen Mary takes place on this date. 1916, the Migratory Bird Treaty between Canada and the U.S. is signed. The birds were not asked what they thought about it. 1918, the Battle of Lake Baikal is fought between Czechoslovak Legion and the Red Army. 1920, Ray Chapman of the Cleveland Indians is hit on the head by a fastball thrown by Carl Mays of the New York Yankees and dies early the next day. Now, Chapman was the second player to die from injuries sustained in a Major League Baseball game, the first being Doc Powers in 1909. Fastballs can put your lights out, no question about that. 1920, the Congress of the Communist Party of Bukhara opens. It would call for armed revolution. 1920, the Poly-Soviet War. The Battle of Radzymin concludes. The Soviet Red Army is forced to turn away from Warsaw. 1923, the UK gives the name Ross Dependency to part of its claimed Antarctic territory and makes the Governor General of the Dominion of New Zealand its administrator. 1927, the Dole Air Force air race begins from Oakland, California to Honolulu, Hawaii, during which 6 out of the 8 participating planes crash or vanish. 1929, the 1929 Palestine riots break out in mandatory Palestine between Palestinian Arabs and Jews and continue until the end of the month. In total, 133 Jews and 116 Arabs are killed. 1930, the first color sound cartoon called Fiddlesticks is released by UB Iwerks. 1930, the first British Empire Games are opened in Hamilton, Ontario by the Governor General of Canada, the Viscount Willingdon. 1933, the Christie Pitts riots take place in Toronto, Ontario. 1942, World War II, a naval L-class blimp drifts in from the Pacific and crashes in Daly City, California. The two-man crew were found to have vanished, with no explanation. They were never found. 1944, the first flight of a jet with forward slip wings, the Junkers, JU-287, took place on this date. 1945, the National Representatives Congress, the precursor of the current National Assembly of Vietnam, convenes in Son Dorong. 1946, mass riots in Kolkata began. More than 4,000 people be killed in 72 hours. A new world record. 1946, the Hyderabad Trade Union Congress is founded in Secunderabad. 1954, the first issue of Sports Illustrated is published on this date. 1960, Cyprus gains its independence from the U.K. Also in 1960, Joseph Kittinger parachutes from a balloon over New Mexico at 102,800 feet. Sets 3 records that held until 2012. High altitude jump, free fall, and high speed by a human without an aircraft. 1962, 8 years after the remaining French Indian territories are handed to India, the ratifications of the treaty are exchanged to make the transfer official. 1964, Vietnam War. A coup d'etat replaces Duong Van Minh with General Nguyen Khan as president of South Vietnam. A new constitution is established with aid from the U.S. Embassy. Of course, we've got to be involved. 1966, Vietnam War. House Un-American Activities Committee begins investigations of Americans who aided the Viet Cong. Committee intends to introduce legislation making these activities illegal. Anti-war demonstrators disrupt the meeting and 50 people are arrested. Doesn't say how many were shot. 1972, In an unsuccessful coup d'etat attempt, the Royal Moroccan Air Force fires on Hassan II of Morocco's plane while he's coming back to Rabat. In 1975, Australian Prime Minister Gough Whitlam symbolically hands over land to the Gurindji people after the eight-year Wave Hill walk-off. That's a landmark event in the history of Indigenous land rights in Australia, commemorated in a 1991 song by Paul Kelly in an annual celebration. 1987, Northwest Airlines Flight 255, a McDonnell Douglas MD-82, crashes after takeoff in Detroit, Michigan. Kills 154 of the 155 on board, plus it hits two people on the ground. Now you know your luck is bad when a plane falls on you. 1989, a solar particle event affects computers at the Toronto Stock Exchange, forces a halt to trading. 1991, Indian Airlines Flight 257, a Boeing 737-200, crashes during approach to Imphal Airport, kills all 69 people on board. 2005, West Caribbean Airways Flight 708, a McDonnell Douglas MD-82, crashes in Mochiquez, Venezuela. All 160 people on board are killed. 2008, the Trump International Hotel and Tower in Chicago was topped off at 1,389 feet. At that point in time, it was the world's highest residence above ground level. 2012, South African police fatally shoot 34 miners and wound 78 more during an industrial dispute at Marikana, which is near Rustenburg. 2013, the ferry St. Thomas Aquinas collides with a cargo ship and sinks in Cebu, Philippines. 61 people are killed and 59 are never accounted for. 2015, more than 96 people are killed and hundreds injured following a series of air raids by the Syrian Arab Air Force on the rebel hill market town of Douma. 2015, Trigana Air Flight 267, an ATR-42, crashes in Asabel, Pegunungan, Biritang, killing all 54 people on board. 2017, the Minamata Convention on Mercury enters in force. And 2020, the enormous August Complex fire in California is reported on this particular date. Burned more than 1 million acres of land. Now they got an even bigger fire going there now. All right, a lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Too many to go into. Holidays and observances, Bennington Battle Day in Vermont, Children's Day in Paraguay, Christian Feast Day, Ana Petra Perez Florido, Armel, Diomedes of Tarsus, Roque, Stephen I of Hungary. Translation of the Hieropolitos icon from Edessa to Constantinople in the Eastern Orthodox Church. Gozan no Okiribi in Kyoto, Japan. National Airborne Day in U.S. Restoration Day in the Dominican Republic. First Day of the Independence Day celebrates independence of Gabon from France in 1960. And Chico La Tada in France. All right, let's see what else we've got. In 1384, Hongwu Emperor of Ming China, Emperor Dong, here's a case of about a couple who tore money bills while fighting over them. Now that's equal to the act of destroying stamp government documents. So the law necessitated 100 flogging. But Hongwu Emperor decides to pardon him. Totally unheard of. 1501, Michelangelo awarded the contract to create a statue of David by the overseers of the Office of Works of the Duma, France's cathedral church. 1570, King Janos Sigismund Zápolyai signs a secret treaty with Maximilian II. 1691, Yorktown, Virginia is founded. 1692, Prince Eugenius of Savoy occupies Belgrade. 1743, the champion of England title holder Jack Bruton publishes the rules of the ring. That was the earliest boxing code. In 1787, Turkey declares war on Russia. In 1794, Hungarian revolutionary Ignác Martinović arrested in Vienna. Now, I talked about the fact that General Hull in 1812 surrendered Detroit and the entire territory to British forces under the command of Major General Sir Isaac Brock. What I didn't say was Brock was helped by Tecumseh, leader of the Shawnee. In 1829, the Siamese twins Chang and Ing Bunker arrive in Boston to be exhibited to the public. In 1861, President Abraham Lincoln formally prohibits the United States from trading with the Confederacy. 1863, the Chickamauga campaign of the Civil War begins in Georgia. 1864, federal assault on the fourth day of the battle at Deep Bottom Run in Virginia. 1864, the Palace for People's Industry officially opens in Amsterdam. 1865, Restoration Day in the Dominican Republic. The Dominican Republic regained its independence after 4 years of fighting against the Spanish annexation. 1870, which is a momentous date in history, Fred Goldsmith demonstrates that a curveball is not really an optical illusion. 1882, British under General Wolseley land in Alexandria. 1894, Indian chiefs from the Sioux and the Onondaga tribes meet to urge their people to renounce Christianity and return to their old Indian faith. 1898, Edwin Prescott patents the roller coaster. On this day in 1904, New York City begins building Grand Central Station. If you've never been there, you need to go. It is a phenomenal facility. 1907, Muley Hafid is proclaimed the Sultan of Morocco by supporters, and that leads to a civil war. Muley is supported by Germany. France supports the existing Sultan. 1908, the Committee of Union and Progress, known as the Young Turks, announces a program for reforms and respect for the rights of all within the Ottoman Empire, regardless of race or religion. Now, words are cheap. Enver Pasha was the leader of the Ottoman Empire at the time. 1914, German army occupies the last fort at Liège. Belgian General Lemon is caught. 1914, Zapata and Pancho Villa overrun Mexico. 1918, U.S. troops are overrun at Arkhangelsk by Bolshevik troops. 1921, the members of the Dáil Parliament swear allegiance to the Irish Republic at their first meeting, held, ironically enough, at Dublin House. 1924, a conference concerning German recovery payments opens in London. 1934, on this date, the U.S. ended occupation of Haiti. We'd been there since 1915. 1934, U.S. explorer William Beebe descends 3,028 feet in the bathysphere. 1936, the 11th Summer Olympic Games closes in Berlin. Hitler was not a happy camper. On this day in 1940, 45 German aircraft shot down over England. In 1943, the first long-time bombs on the Italian mainland were shot from Sicily. And on this day in 1944, the U.S. 15th Army Corps reaches Uri and surrounds Drux. And in 1945, Puyi, the last Chinese emperor and ruler of Manchukuo, which was the Japanese-occupied Manchuria, is captured by Soviet troops. All right, on that note, we've been talking about cities found on Mars. And we're going to keep talking about it. NASA has gone out of its way to cover up the entire thing. They, Let's see. All right. Now, after Christensen made his presentation and said that the material had never been changed, Barra and Hoagland proved that in fact the material had been changed on the website. And within a few days of that public revelation, Internet Archive ceased tracking any changes to the Themis ASU image release pages and deleted the records about that page, which means the fix had to be in. It was hard to tell from Christensen's reaction whether he was so nervous because he was afraid he was going to get caught, or whether he was under some pressure from outside forces to keep the story straight, in spite of evidence to the contrary. Nobody really knew if Christensen was friend or foe of the independent investigations. On the one hand, he had given the data to prove the outside research's thesis beyond any reasonable doubt. And on the other hand, he'd participated, at least tacitly, in an attempt to discredit that same investigation. And he'd gone to great lengths at the conference to avoid accusing anybody of faking the real IR data. But the confrontation seemed to send shockwaves through the planetary science community, which promptly went on the attack against Richard Hoagland, who was in the public face of the investigation. And this came in the form of a newly minted debunker, as they like to call themselves, Phil Platt. Or Plate. He fancied himself the successor to Carl Sagan as the debunker of all things paranormal. He followed in the footsteps of such characters as James Randi, Jim Olberg, and Philip Klass. He created a blog site he called Bad Astronomy, where he used to attack anybody who dared challenge whatever NASA had to say about UFOs, Mars, or even climate science. And he went to great lengths to make it clear he did not, never had work for NASA. Of course, he does take grant money from them, but that's not working for him. Those are gifts, recognizing his genius. Just like a judge here who took a $10,000 bribe. It wasn't a bribe, it was a recognition of his judicial brilliance. Now, Plague got involved in a Sidonia fray after the confrontation between Mike Barr and Christensen at Caltech. And he dedicated a whole series of pages to attacking Hoagland specifically. And most of the information he posted was just a rehash of discredited arguments that had been covered in a number of books. In fact, it seemed to a number of people Plate was actually obsessed with Hoagland and jealous of the amount of attention he could generate. And that led him to make numerous bad arguments, false claims, and even a few outright lies. One of the statements he made that seemed a little out of... unnecessary, I guess you could say. He said, Hoagland's stock and trade is in grossly misinterpreting images used by taking compressed JPEGs and enlarging them beyond their resolution. Sometimes he just looks at images and makes stuff up out of the air. He wrote a whole book on the face on Mars, which is really just a hill. Well, even as little as I know about it, these statements were false. I mean, I've read most of what Hoagland has written, and none of it was a whole book about the face of Mars. He did talk about it. And he very rarely processes the images he discusses, even though after 35 years of working with digital images, he's, I would guess, pretty good at it. And whenever possible, the images are not compressed JPEGs, but full-resolution source images, usually lossless file formats like TIFFs. They're simply copied to JPEG format after processing for placement on the internet, because it reduces the size of the pictures to something manageable. Even I know that. And he never enlarges them, from what I've seen, beyond their resolution. That was another false claim constantly spread by critics of the Sidonia investigation ever since Carl Sagan made that assertion in a Parade magazine story I read back in 85. But what Plate overlooks is that the majority of the image enhancement work done over the years on the face or other Mars anomalies isn't done by Hoagland, but by contractors, scientists, and interested professionals. He just seemed to overlook that. Well, you know, no matter what Platt says, compression artifacts simply do not create false structures on data. Certainly, they don't create objects that show identifiable signs of architectural design intent, like tube-like objects that terminate at the base of buildings with openings in them. JPEG compression artifacts always run north-south in an image. The block-like city structures don't. They run true Sidonia north-south and are present whether the images are rotated or not. This means they couldn't have been introduced when the image was rotated. In addition, compression artifacts are well understood and easily accounted for by an imaging specialist who certainly wouldn't mistake them for real buildings on or underneath the Martian surface. And that's why Plate is adamant he wants his readers to believe Hoagland did all the enhancement work himself, and by implication doesn't understand what JPEG artifacts are. Despite, in numerous articles even I've read, he discussed them ad nauseum. In reality, it's Plate who is deliberately deceiving the readers in an attempt to discredit Hoagland. And unfortunately for Plate, he missed one important fact that blows his JPEG compression theory out of the water. None of the Sidonia thermal IR images processed were JPEGs. They were, in fact, all TIFF files, a compression-free image format that makes it impossible to introduce these artifacts. In fact, if you'd actually read the story he linked to, which he asserts he did since he refers to it as rambling, he would have noted it included links to the full-size TIFF file so others could also work with the data. The JPEG files he refers to are just versions that could have been browsed through very quickly. So how could somebody who described himself as a genius astronomer, who thinks enough of himself to spend so much energy criticizing others, have missed this point? That seems to be a mystery to many people. Unless he knew full well all the processing work had been done on full resolution uncompressed TIFFs. Unless his intent was to deceive his readers. Well, and the attacks on the Sidonia infrared data were actually very predictable, especially coming from folks who actually paid to be professional debunkers. The Themis processed imagers are nothing less than the smoking gun data the independent researchers have been seeking for decades. never any question that those who had staked their professional reputations and are continuing grant money on the NASA story that the face was just a hill, they would only misrepresent the data as they had done so many times before. They have a party line they have to defend, and they're paid to defend it, and they do their job well. Now, what everybody in retrospect should have known was that there would be those in the independent research community who might actually take that same stance. And just as the Brookings report had predicted, the revelation of the truth of a superior ancient alien civilization would be too much for a lot of folks to bear. Well, you have to ask yourself, if NASA, who has spent billions of taxpayer dollars to take photographs, why would they fake them? And why would they refuse to relieve them to the people that paid for them? Now, there's been quite a number of disagreements in the research community. Everybody wants to be first. And even after the Sidonia infrared image debacles of 2002 and 3, there was still hope that independent researchers might get some good data from other sources. And while the thermal IR data was valuable by the mid-2000s, still hadn't gotten a single direct overhead visual image of the face on Mars or a single color image of Sidonia. But a new probe from the European Space Agency called the Mars Express held out a hope for delivering both. It carried an instrument called a high-resolution stereo camera, and it promised images of visual resolution as high as 14 MPP, even better than the 19 MPP visual light camera that had traveled to Mars on NASA's 2001 Mars Odyssey spacecraft. Even better than that, it would take images in full color as well as stereo, meaning the 3D anagraphs would be generated from the data, which would give everybody their first legitimate 3D views of the Sidonian landscape. Well, after several unsatisfactory attempts to image the Sidonia region in a December 2004 photographic window, on September 21, 2006, the European Space Agency finally released the first HRSC color imagery of the Sidonia region of Mars. And unlike its earlier partial release of the 2004 data, this one came captured and included a politicized press release that emphasized the usual non-arguments about the face on the surface of Mars being artificial. It was taken July 22, 2006, under a lot better lighting conditions than the 2004 images from straight overhead. And they were 13.7 meter per pixel images, provided the best overview yet of the area and become known as Sidonia Complex. And what it revealed was a stunning landscape that's strongly confirmative of almost all the independent researchers' expectations and predictions. In many ways, because they're color, these two stereo images are far more illuminating than supposedly higher resolution images generated by the Mars Global Surveyor. In fact, it's quite clear from examining the new images that the previous Mars Global Surveyor images of the face leave quite a lot to be desired. Now, we're going to do a brief review of the concept of spatial resolution in remote sensing satellite imagery. Now, most folks assume that an image with a stated resolution of 1.2 meters per pixel, like the high-rise camera on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter can sometimes provide, is automatically better than the image of 13.7 meters per pixel, such as those the Mars Express carried. Most of the time, that might be true, but there's a lot more to it than that. If the 1.2 meter per pixel image is grayscale, which means it's an 8-bit data, it by definition carries less information than the 16-bit or 32-bit color image. And furthermore, all kinds of conditions, atmospheric haze, lighting, or the sun angles, camera settings, the optical properties of the camera, what filters are being used, can all dramatically affect the quality of the resulting image. Well, a good case in point would be the infamous cat box image of the face of Mars. There was a TJP enhancement of the infamous and fraudulent cat box image of the face of Mars taken in 1998. And while it's unquestionably the best enhancement of this image to date, it's also of very poor quality. Now, according to the Malin Space Science System website, the image had a spatial resolution of 4.3 meters per pixel, making it by far the best image of the face up to that point. But this stated resolution only takes into account the maximum possible resolution based on the camera optics and the altitude above the target. The image was in fact taken after the spacecraft had already passed over the face, looking back up to the north from a 45-degree angle to the west. In addition, at least 50% of the data was stripped out by using an exceptionally large image swath. The result was an extremely dark, low-contrast image that didn't come close to the imaging capabilities that camera had under ideal conditions. Vince DiPietro, an early pioneer of face research, concluded that all the factors included, the effective spatial resolution of the image was 14 meters per pixel as opposed to the stated 4.3 or the optimum 1.2 meters per pixel capability of the camera. By contrast, the new ESA images were taken from directly overhead at close to minimum altitude under full daylight conditions with virtually no cloud cover and in 24-bit color. And beyond that, unlike any of the previous missions, the HRSC is able to take images virtually side by side one after the other. And the results were definitely impressive. The two stereo images taken just moments apart provide the best overall view of the face and the city that has been seen from any mission so far. And both frames captured the face as well as other objects of interest in the Sedonia, like the building that's called the Fort and the D&M and the city in high-resolution color. And the first image provides the added bonus of capturing the cliff in the lower portion of the frame. And a substantial number of the anomalous mesas north of the face, first noted by Hoagland in his book, The Monuments of Mars. What all this amounts to is these images were without a doubt the best wide-angle view we'd ever had of Sedonia. So having gone through all that, what did we learn? Well, for starters, it's immediately obvious Sedonia is a very strange place, at least as far as any natural explanation for its formation goes. Most of the named formations that researchers are familiar with look just as we would expect them to. And other formations don't seem to fare as well under high resolution, especially the Fort. The Mars Express color image is by far the most detailed view of this object yet, despite the fact that the grayscaled MGS image has a higher theoretical spatial resolution. At first glance, the newer images of the Fort and some of the other Sedonia anomalies would seem to undermine arguments for their artificiality. But the Fort can be clearly seen to rest on a triangular platform, which, with a collapsed peak that has to be triangular in nature, since the Viking data left a distinctly triangular shadow, which gave the illusion of an inner wall at a 60-degree angle. Simply put, a triangular pyramid-shaped shadow can't be produced by anything except a triangular pyramid-shaped object. An example of this would be the Great Pyramids at Giza. At low sun angles, similar to the conditions at Sedonia when the Viking images were taken, they project long, pointed triangular shadows, identical to the pointed triangular shadows seen by the peak of the Fort on Mars. So this is not an optical illusion, folks, but an accurate reflection of the shape of the tip of the pyramids. So it follows the Fort has an identical pointed artificial peak casting a similar shadow. So you have to ask yourself, then, what is the Fort? It appears to be a collapsed tetrahedral pyramid. Looking at later data, it's clear that it has a triangular base that served as the foundation, probably supported by a central column holding up the peak and its three spars at each apex. And this would leave an enormous interior volume for living space, something like the Luxor Hotel in Las Vegas. And I've been there, and it's phenomenal. And will fit with the model that these ruins are architectural ecologies, self-contained pyramidal cities capable of supporting thousands of inhabitants. Well, at some point in the past, the structure was inundated by a massive landslide from the northwest, which broke down and bent over the pillars, allowing the central peak to collapse straight down but maintaining its basic pointed shape. Now, this impression is reinforced when a tetrahedral form is superimposed over an image of the fort itself, showing that the three straight lines that make up the equilateral base of the tetrahedron match almost perfectly with the foundation of the fort. It's also an observation that is only strengthened by the higher resolution, more directly overhead views produced by Mars Express. It's very difficult to see how these proportions can be found in a naturally occurring landform. Erosion simply does not produce naturally perfect equilateral triangles except under the rarest and most bizarre circumstances, and never within a stone's throw of the massive petrogonal pyramids and 1.5-mile-wide naturally sculpted human face. The D&M pyramid, just a few miles south of the face in the fort, is another example of how the Mars Express camera added to the mystery and archaeological intrigue of Sidonia. Under time resolution view, the D&M's artificial construction becomes very clear. The Mars Express view shows the object in much better context, emphasizing the strange circular platform from which the pyramid rises about 2,500 feet above the plain. And the Mars Express image is also dramatically better than the 2001 Mars Odyssey visual camera image, showing more detail than can be discerned in the grayscale image while losing none of the critical context. In this detail, we can see the lines of bilateral symmetry, the exit wound, as it's called, to the east, and inward collapse of at least one facet of the pyramid. But it's in the 3D stereo images that the HRSC camera really pays for itself. The 3D views are an intended benefit of the stereo capabilities of this camera, created pretty much automatically from the existence of two nearly identical data sets. These perspective views offer us the ability to fly over Sidonia at a resolution never imagined before. What they show is the overtly, but fractally eroded, pyramidal form of the D&M, arguing this formation is anything but a construct to be absurd in the face of this type of data. But perhaps no member of the existing Sidonia complex is revealed as more alien than the curiously straight-edged cliff. First noted by Richard Hoagland back in the early days of the Sidonia investigation, the cliff is an anomalously straight ridge perched atop the ejecta blanket of a nearby crater. It's formed, along with the tetrahedral apex of the tholus and the rim pyramid of the nearby crater, one of the key 19.5 alignments in the Sidonia geometric relationship model. The argument for its possible artificiality is always centered around the fact that it is not only a completely bizarre geomorphology. I mean, let's face it, a near perfectly straight ridge is running for miles, but that it rested on a raised platform of some type, which seemed to postdate the crater impact. And later resolution, high-resolution images from Mars Global Surveyor, the 2001 Mars Odyssey, now Mars Express, supports this theory. There's no evidence that the ejecta has splattered on top of the cliff. The entire mesa just seemed to have been stamped on top of the ejecta blanket. After more than a generation, the conclusion that this anomalously straight-edged ridge somehow postdated the cratering event would have been considered validated. And that's a geological impossibility, but the new images also cast light on another object of interest in Sidonia just southwest of the face. Described in the SA article accompanying New Sidonia images as a skull-shaped mesa, this object has fascinated investigators since it was first noted in the original Catbox image strip. The new ESA image showed that what appeared in the Viking data to be simply a natural mesa among the ruins of Sidonia was in fact an intriguingly symmetrical object more than a mile across. Now, the odd ESA description of it as a skull-shaped is attributed to a claim by ESA that some people have referred to it as such. Now, I've not read anything or heard anything supporting the proposition, this description, in any has been used by anybody. The mesa in question has certainly been intriguing for several reasons. Its significant degree of symmetry, its proximity to a tetrahedral ruin about the size of the Great Pyramid of Giza, which Hoagland noted in 1998, and the existence of a tunnel or channel terminating at the exact lateral center of the Mesa and the Mars Odyssey infrared data. The skull reference is a design distraction to keep readers from, or those who view it, from viewing it as a perspective, from a perspective that makes the symmetry more obvious. The symmetrical mesa, the Fort and the D&M, along with a series of anomalous objects north of the city and the face, are excellent examples of a phenomenon called fractal erosion. In mathematics, a fractal is a data set that displays self-similar characteristics. In other words, it assumes that a given object resembles itself at different levels of magnification. For example, the face on Mars still looks like a face at both lower resolution from Viking and higher resolution from the MRO. With fractal erosion, the concept's taken a step further to predict that a given object is also generally erodes along the lines of its original shape. So we can actually reverse the erosional process and reconstruct the original shape of a given object by studying how it appears today. Using this methodology, satellite imaging expert Errol Toron did a study of the original shape of the D&N pyramid in the early 1990s. And there's been a number of similar reconstructions of various objects around Cydonia. When you do that, the skull-shaped mesa becomes more overtly symmetrical. The original shape of a number of objects in the north become highly geometric. Now, this area, dubbed Super Bowl City by researcher Robert Harrison, the Cydonia Quest website, was first noted by Hoagland in his book Monuments. It contains a wealth of geometric ruins that are nearly inexplicable by natural erosive processes. In fact, all the mesas in this particular area are very unusual, but the four that I've mentioned seem to be the most non-natural and most consistent with the other anomalies at Cydonia. The far left, object, dubbed the West Mound by Harrison, is remarkably similar to other objects at Cydonia, like the D&M and the main pyramid in the city. So what we've got is visual proof that there exists on the surface of Mars a ruined city that predates probably the human civilization. Just a short distance from the West Mound, there are two more objects that really defy conventional explanation. One is a bizarre H-shaped formation. Once again, we can see the unaccountable symmetry of the Mesa and Cydonia, this time in the shape of an H. The fractal reconstruction shows it was once a wedge-shaped structure, probably a hollow arcology, which has collapsed inward around the H-shaped frame. This superstructure was clearly just sagging and caved in, but just as obviously it was once a far more robust and majestic building. Directly adjacent to what looks to be a bulging bunker with a vertical face, it could be judged as entrances. Assuming the reconstruction is valid, and it would seem to be, then these two adjacent structures could easily be deemed artificial. If they appeared on images anywhere on Earth, it would be doubtful their artificiality would be at all questioned. And just south of this complex is another object nicknamed the Super Bowl by Bob Harrison. Other than the bowl, though, the object in question is actually a rounded mound about the size of some of the pyramids in the city. In the ESA images, a distinct moat can be seen around the circumference of the mound, indicating it's sunk at least partially into the surrounding terrain. Now, close-ups done by Harrison show that there are large pits or sinkholes around the base of the structure, implying that it's settling into a hollow or collapsing inward from the base into its hollowed-out interior. Obviously, neither of the characteristics is consistent with a naturally eroding object, unless it's some bizarre example of volcanism which forms with air pockets inside. And this notion is dispelled by looking at the exposed upper surfaces of the mound, which display the all-too-familiar rectangular room-sized cells where the casing structure appears to have been worn away, which means that these structures are quite old, folks. This is consistent with observations from the D&M, the so-called main pyramid in the city. All of them display these irregular, repeating, geometrically arranged cells. They're confirmation of the core idea that these are constructed objects. The best, those we're saving for last. Just a little further east of this collection of objects is a very strange triangular-shaped mesa that seems to have three matching geometric nodes at each of the triangle's vortices. It's eroded, to be sure, but what kind of natural process erodes a simple hill under a base equilateral triangle with such overly geometric nodes at each corner? This mesa is an anomaly as it gets, and Fredonia, that's saying something. When you go into the details of the triangular mesa, there are even more strangers. Just to the left of the northernmost node is a very odd dark feature that appears in both the December 2005 and July 2006 data sets. It's a very distinct T. It's a very dark marking on the structures, not only aligned perfectly north-south, as is the triangle mesa itself, but its two dark lines intersect at precisely 90 degrees. Now that's an interesting accomplishment for a naturally eroding mesa. The more recent image suggests that these dark interconnected lines may demark the edges of the eroding upper node, perhaps where the base of the node is slumped inward, although in a very precise and geometric fashion. With its strange markings, triangular base, and geometric nodes, this triangular arcology is more than anomalous enough to be added to the candidates list for artificiality of Cydonia. And now, saving the best for last, let's talk about the face. You would think after all the images now taken of this enigmatic object that there'd be little, if anything, new that could be learned about the face. But despite the fact that there are now some 25 partial complete views of it from five different missions and cameras, the mystery of the face continues on. Not only do these new color images tell us new details about the face itself, they serve to point out the problems and issues with earlier images of the face, even at the supposedly higher resolutions that we talked about before. The first thing we note is that while the east and west sides of the face are made of two distinct materials, their surface color is predominantly uniform. This indicates that whatever is covering most of the Cydonia region is most likely a layer of reddish dust. It's not called the Red Planet for nothing, folks. This also completely refutes Christensen's assertion in July of 2003 that the cliffside was covered with a dense snowpack. That's accounting for the dramatically anomalous reflection seen in the pre-dawn Themis color image from 2003. If this dense layer of snow did exist, we'd see it in the color images as a bright white casing around the base of the face. Well, since it doesn't appear, we can judge that the anomalous brightening in the Themis image was due to another cause. Another thing these images provide is confirmation of earlier observations. Secondary facial characteristics, which flatly can't exist if the arguments for a natural origin of the face are valid, are confirmed in the ESA images. We can plainly see two nostrils in the nose, which first appeared on the infamous Catbox image of 98, and then seemed to disappear in the low-contrast MGS images taken from above the forehead of the face in 2001. Their reappearance is due to a simple function of spacecraft geometry. These are the first images taken from almost directly overhead, as opposed to the many MGS images that were substantially up-track or down-track from the face's actual latitude. In addition, we see the sharply defined brow ridges on both sides of the face, as well as the overall symmetry of the base of the base platform. Indeed, the most compelling observation that Mars Express provides is that two eye sockets precisely align straight across the face. This is in sharp contrast to the MGS images over the last couple of years, which have shown the eye sockets to be substantially out of alignment and the face platform to be substantially wider than it actually is. Now, this difference is actually due to two factors. The first one is the more directly overhead image angle taken by the Mars Express instrument, and the improper orthographic rectification of the Mars Global Survey images contributed substantially to the distortion and the overall illusion of asymmetry. In fact, the Malan ortho rectification so bad that it widens the base, twists the nose, and pulls the right eye socket significantly below that of the left. But if you look at a side-by-side comparison, you see just how far off the Malan version is. But if the Malan NASA version is bad, then the ortho-rectification produced by Dr. Mark Collado from the 2001 MGS image is positively abysmal. No wonder nobody in NASA seems to want to see the face the way the outside researchers do. Because if they admit that it's artificial, then they have violated their basic tenet of admitting that there are others in the solar system besides us. When all the illustrations, all this illustrates is that orthographic rectification is something of a black art, and even those who claim to have been mastered can be exposed in the light of day as not really knowing what they're talking about. Seeing the questions of the position of the two eye sockets and the existence of the nostrils are forever settled, once again, independent researchers came out on top. But none of this, though, seemed to move the powers that be within the mainstream astrophysics community. European Space Agency's release of its Cydonia data was accompanied with a typically shallow and half-hearted naysaying article claiming once again that there was nothing at all unusual about the face, that it really wasn't a face. Which seems kind of silly when you think about it. The photographs make it clear that, in fact, it is an artificial face. Now, when you look at all the people who are saying, golly gee whiz, no, in almost every case, to include the European Space Agency, there is U.S. government money somewhere in the background. You don't bite the hand that feeds you. If the U.S. government says there's nothing to it, then there's nothing to it. It's when any outside researchers who say differently are discredited or attacked, just like UFO witnesses are. I know when I had my run-in in South America, after being accused of being drunk on duty, the colonel told me that I needed to remember I hadn't seen anything. And I said, I almost certainly did. We shot 2,500 rounds of live ammo at it. He said, nope, that was a training miscalculation of ammunition. You didn't see anything if you want to remain an officer. Which I thought was an interesting attitude for him to take. Well, we have come to the end of tonight's show. We're going to continue for a few more shows talking about anomalies on Mars and on the Moon and elsewhere in the solar system. We hadn't even begun to discuss the Black Knight satellite that was found when Russia first went into space. We don't know who put it there. We don't know what it's doing. We don't know why it's there. It's just there. It was in a polar orbit, something we didn't achieve for quite some time. Well, on that note, we're going to wrap up tonight's show. We'll be back tomorrow night when, once again, you'll be listening to Ken Hudnall on the Ken Hudnall Show. Until then, have a truly great evening.